What is... Dax, are you...
Tracking all our cars on Carvana Value Tracker? On all our devices? Yes, Kristen, yes I am.
Well, I've been looking for my phone for...
In Dax's domain, we see all. So we always know what our cars are worth.
All of them?
All of them. Value surge! Trucks up 3.9%!
That's a great offer.
I know. Sell?
Sell.
Track your car's value with Carvana Value Tracker today.
Hey, it's Gemma Spegg, host of the Open Mind original podcast, Mantra. Every Monday, I'll bring you a new mantra, a simple yet powerful phrase to help you clear your mind and stay grounded amidst the chaos. I'll also share some personal stories, journal prompts, and a weekly challenge to bring each mantra to life. Follow and listen to Mantra, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with Open Mind Studios, available now on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
GS on KMOX. That was pretty aggressive, wasn't it? Like a real broadcaster.
Yeah, but the music was loud, so you know it makes sense.
You got to get after it, yeah.
You do got to get after it sometimes.
Yeah, when the music's up there, you got to get up there.
Yeah.
That's how that goes.
You're competing with Jack White, for goodness sake.
Yeah, there's no competing with Jack.
Mm-mm.
There's only being second. Razor's Edge?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the fact that the National Archives is looking for volunteers with an increasingly rare skill. Would anyone like to guess what it is?
They know how to work the Dewey Decimal System.
Good guess.
Yeah, microfiche. Whatever that is.
I was going to say, what?
It's like a tiny newspaper or something.
That's okay. How they used to save newspapers. It would be like they...
Oh, my God. You guys are making me feel so old. I had to use microfiche in college.
Yeah.
How do they get it so tiny?
That's like taking photographs or something.
You take fiche and you shrink them.
How do they get the fiche so small?
What's a fiche?
It's like a little thing that lives in the ocean.
This is my fish.
This is my fishy.
This is my goldfish.
Let's go fishing.
No, they're looking for volunteers to read cursive because this is a skill that is going away. A lot of people cannot read cursive.
I'm your boy.
They're calling it a superpower, actually. And they have more than 200 years worth of U.S. documents that need transcribing or at least classifying. The vast majority of them are from the Revolutionary War, and they're handwritten in cursive.
Did you learn cursive, you and Andrew?
Yeah. Yeah, I think we probably are some of the last generations to learn it.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I was looking into this, so school children were once taught handwriting and penmanship, and that was something they were graded on. But that started to change in about the 80s, whenever this started to be replaced by computers. But, you know, they still taught handwriting at the majority of schools until the 1990s. When many people shifted to email and then to texting. By 2010, the Common Core teaching standards emphasized keyboard skills and no longer required handwriting on the presumption that most of the writing students would be doing would be on computers.
Yeah.
So that did lead to pushback, and at least 14 states required that cursive handwriting be taught, including California, which surprised me. In 2023, they said you have to teach handwriting to kids. That doesn't mean that they're actually using it in real life.
I was literally a science experiment. My era, we were taught ITA, which was a completely different kind of writing. And so, for example, the word pale, P-A-L-E, the A and the E were connected. It was P-A-E-L.
Why?
Don't know. And then that was first and second grade. And then in third grade, they're like, okay, forget all that. Pale is P-A-L-E. And I wasn't all that bright. And I'm like, what the hell? And here's how you make block letters. Okay. And then they're like, now we're going to teach a cursive. I'm like, look, mofo, like how many different kinds of writing styles can one guy learn? Where's the microfiche? And so, yeah, I know three kind of... I looked up the ITA the other day. Anyone my age remembers this? And it freaked me out because I could read it. I mean, it like all came back.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it was really weird.
I remember looking that up the first time you talked about it, and it looks crazy.
It was crazy. Because you would read whole books in ITA.
Wow.
Yeah.
What does ITA stand for?
It's a great question. I don't know. I don't know. I'm sure it was spelled weird, though.
Now, the other interesting thing here is that AI can only go so far when it comes to cursive for a variety of reasons. One being, it just has a hard time reading these handwritten documents, and they still need a human person to do the final edit for stuff like the National Archives.
How
because
interesting.
AI makes so many mistakes.
Huh.
AI can't always decipher the documents. A lot of times they've been torn, they've been folded, they've been dog-eared, smudged. So it just has a hard time picking up on this. And a lot of times these people in the 1700s, 1800s, they just had straight up bad handwriting, and mm-hmm. it's hard for the AI to compute that. Mm-hmm. So they need a human to go in and take care of it.
Yeah, I'm the executor of my mom's will, and we're selling her house. And I just this weekend found the original deed, handwritten from 1951.
Whoa, that's cool.
Dang.
It was really cool.
That is actually a historical document.
It really is. Yeah. And I didn't like look at like how much did they pay for the lot, how much did they this. I will do that before I hand it over to the probate attorney. But then just today, I signed a deal to sell my mom's house, and I'm so conflicted because I wasn't going to keep the house. My sister didn't want the house. Neither of us wanted to own it and rent it. So it was going to go away. So it's a good thing. It's a big thing off my plate, but it's sad. Like, I don't know if you guys have ever been through that, like losing a childhood home, but it's weird. It's just weird to think other people are going to go in there and they're going to live their life there, and my bedroom will be their bedroom. It's just kind of odd.
Yeah, we moved a lot, so.
You didn't have like a.
Yeah, so we had one house that we grew up in, and I think it was after eighth grade we moved. And then after high school, when I was in college, my parents moved. My parents moved by choice. My dad just liked moving, building new houses and moving mm-hmm. to new ones. In college, they had a new one that replaced my high school house. And then not long after that, there was another one that replaced that house.
Hmm.
So I didn't have that long. Like, think of how long. That was your entire life. That's different. Like, yeah. I get that.
From 0 to 60.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like, that's a different thing. You were there all the time for all that time. Where for me, it's always been something different. It's always been a different place.
Rach, which one of your houses do you have the most connection with?
Yeah, because I was very similar to Wheels in that we moved a lot. There was a house, it was a red brick house. And it's so weird. I was just talking about this with Kurt yesterday because we were talking about Y2K. And I was like, the only thing I really remember from Y2K is my dad buying cases of water. And then we kept them in this little closet that was in the basement that I hadn't thought of that room in probably 20 years. But yeah, that was the house. We didn't have a finished basement, but we had like rugs down on the floor and like a couch down there. And that was like me and my brother's play area. And we just played for hours and hours and hours. That's like my most fond memories.
Yeah,
with that
awesome.
House for sure. And that was like probably the ages of 8 to 11, mm-hmm. 8 to 10.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would have to say the first house, because once you're in high school, you don't spend much time at a house. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you're in high school, you're not there a lot.
Unless you're me and you're a dork.
And then in college, when I was almost never there because I was off in college. So that first one would be the one where you spent the most hours mm-hmm. playing video games, playing basketball in the backyard, playing hockey in the basement, mm-hmm. doing baseball stuff, all that stuff.
It's going to be weird. Both Nick and Phoebe want to go back one last time. And I will be there a few times because, you know, when you're selling a house, you have to show up for this or that. But the last time I closed that door, I'm getting emotional right now.
I'm sure. Yeah.
It's going to be so weird.
So how was the penmanship on that deed that you found?
That's what made me think of it. It was very Revolutionary War flowy.
Yeah. Flowy? It had cool. flourishes?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
It looks like something you'd see on Ancestry.com because it is.
Do you think there's stuff in your mom's house now that you have? Like, I know you've spent a lot of time going through the stuff there, but do you think there's stuff there that you still haven't uncovered
100%.
And that's going to surprise you when you're moving stuff out?
100%. Yeah, and it's one of the things, we sold it to one of these companies where they take everything, lock, stock, and barrel. And they're like, look, you take anything you want. You take mementos, you take furniture, leave it empty, but whatever you leave, we'll take, and we'll either keep it or we'll sell it or we'll throw it away. And I don't want my mom's couch, but I also don't want to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, you don't want to get thrown away.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's just kind of weird. Or the chair that my mom sat in all the time. I don't want that, because I'm sure it smells to high heaven with cigarette smoke. But at the same time, like, that's my mom's chair. Mm-hmm. That's where she sat half my life.
Yeah. You guys want to turn away from the old-timey cursive handwriting to something futuristic here for Razor's Edge? Okay. Did you guys see CES 2025 just took place? And there's a company willing to sell you a robot girlfriend if you have $175,000 to spare. Have you seen this robot? Her name is Aria.
Yes, I have.
She's got the long blonde hair.
Yes.
A very pretty robot, I guess. But it's by an American firm called Realbotics, and they have a range of AI robots that they say can fulfill a variety of roles, including being your girlfriend, but you can also have it as a companion for an elderly person or a brand representative at a sales booth, which is very interesting. You go up to a sales booth and you're talking to a kind of realistic looking robot. I don't know. I just thought Aria was very interesting because she looks like a person, but she definitely doesn't look like a person at the same
time.
She's
not fooling anybody.
No.
It's like a life-size Barbie doll.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it, Wheels. She is like a Barbie.
Which is kind of weird.
So this company, you can either buy a bust, like a talking head and shoulders that maybe you would place on a table and just talk to. I'm assuming this is for more of like the elderly people wanting a companion. That starts at $12,000. And then Aria, the full-blown like humanoid robot, is $175,000. You can even get a mid-range model that costs $150,000 that can be disassembled and packaged into a suitcase to take with you if you're traveling.
Okay. Hold on, I gotta unpack my robot girlfriend.
I saw what are those things that you guys had when you were little, Rach? Takamuchis, Takagumis,
Tamagotchi.
It looks like that. It's about the same size, but it's AI. It's $500. But it does the same thing. Like, it's a little handheld thing with a little cute little face, kind of like Wall-E. But when you get home, it's like, hey, Dave, how was your day? Oh, it wasn't too bad. Andrew had a weird thing on the Google Doc. Oh, Andrew, what was it? Like, you know, it's that kind of thing. It remembers past conversations. It, you know, I don't know that I need one of those, but for $500... For like an elderly loved one or something like that, that would be kind of cool.
I think something like that is great, honestly, because how many elderly people spend all of their time either, you know, listening to the radio or watching television because they don't really have anyone to converse with and they'd rather just hear some voices?
Yeah.
If they have something they can actually have a realistic conversation with, I think that's wonderful, honestly.
Agreed.
But yeah, just I thought the Aria thing was very interesting because, like I said, she kind of looks like a person, but mostly doesn't. And we do have a long way to go when it comes to these humanoid robots.
I know that finding a partner is not all about how much money you have, but kind of sad that you could afford $200,000 for a fake girlfriend, but can't get a real one, right? Like, the math don't math.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense. Unless you just want something that it's like,
you
she never disagrees
control.
With me. Yeah.
Right.
And she fits in my suitcase. I don't have to buy an extra airplane seat for her. I just check her and then she's in Hawaii whenever I show up.
We're laughing, but it's exactly what people will do.
It's like being a ventriloquist.
She fits in the overhead.
What about when people start doing that, taking Aria to Cancun and taking Aria to dinner in Cancun? How long until that's normalized?
Never.
You don't think it'll ever be normal?
I don't think so.
See, I feel like if I live to my mom's age, there will be Aria taking care of me in the nursing home.
That I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see AI-fueled robots doing difficult jobs. Cause that's a tough job.
Yeah.
Like, and they would probably, in many cases, do it because you're doing it without the physical fatigue.
Without the emotion.
Without the psychological fatigue that comes along with doing those jobs. So I can definitely see that. I'm not saying it won't be. I just don't think it's going to be super common because I think it'll always be judged.
Yeah, I think I'll never not think it's weird if I like roll up to the beach and the guy next to me is like my robot girlfriend. It's a big difference between like this is a robot that helps me take care of my elderly, you know, mother and father, and then like. This is a robot that I'm going to go behind closed doors with later.
Well, what about
I'm taking it to the beach or whatever? You know, that's just yeah.
Well, what about like becoming genuine? Or I hate to use the term genuine, but like you become friends with the robot, and then it's like, hey, Arya's coming with me because that's my girl, and like she helps out with my mom, and then afterwards we're gonna go grab drinks because she's just kind of a part of the family now. Like I could see like a slow build towards that, and then suddenly it's not so weird if you have a romantic relationship. I mean, I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying I could see the slippery slope.
Better for lonely
to
people
now.
To have Arya than not. You think?
Yeah, I think so.
I would love to know how that... I would love to know what a psychological study would show on that. Because if it's good for people, then good. Right? I mean, we don't all have the same experience. So
yeah,
if there are people that it's good for, that's great.
225 DGS. Weird coincidences. I was watching... it was either Josh Gates, Expedition Unknown, or Unsolved Mysteries... just this weekend, and they had one on Jack the Ripper, and they were talking about the three main suspects, but then they said, but now we figured it out. And it was the granddaughter of the chief investigator back in London who figured it out. And the guy's name was Chaim Hyams, and he was in a lunatic asylum. And he went into the asylum at the same time that the murder stopped, and he frequented that neighborhood where all the prostitutes were killed, and that's who it was. Case closed. One of the other two suspects was a 23-year-old son of a doctor named Kaminsky, and just today they came out that they found DNA on one of the murder victim's sweaters. And it's Kaminsky. And I just thought, like, poor Chaim Hyams' family.
Yeah.
Who this national television show is like, that's the guy. It was Kevin Wheeler, 100%.
Dang it.
And then it wasn't. But also pretty freaky that we now seem to know who it was.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It makes you wonder about, like, how ethical any of this true crime stuff is.
Really does.
Because it's like, we know who it is. We know for a fact. And then you find out later, no, not so much.
Not so much.
But there's been so much speculation. And then how much of the focus is, the poor sex workers who lost their lives, like how much focus was really given to the victims in this case? Probably none. I mean, it's just kind of crazy to think about.
Yeah, that's kind of a general issue I have with a lot of the true crime entertainment that is so popular now is that it feels like very little respect is ever given to the victims. You know what I mean? I don't know. It just seems like exploitation.
Look, I am not above watching true crime. Once you go down that rabbit hole, you can get, next thing you know, you look up and 8 hours have gone by and you've been watching Dateline the whole time. But it does feel icky. There's just something about that cottage industry of... You know, and then she was murdered and blah, blah, blah. It's like, you feel kind of like you need to take a shower.
Yeah.
After watching
it. Icky's a good word for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different when it's a show that is trying to draw conclusions that had not been reached before. Like if you're doing your own investigation, because then who's making sure that you follow rules and doing all that stuff? If it's just documenting things that have happened or that were borne out in court, I think there's a natural curiosity about why people do terrible things. And, you know, because terrible things don't always make sense to people. You know what I mean? Like when you see somebody, wow, that guy murdered all that. Why did he do that? Understanding that or trying to is a natural, like to me, it's a human thing. Like, why would somebody do that? That's crazy.
Yeah. And a lot of women really like true crime because, you know, it's said that it's like, hey, this is my fear that this is going to happen to me, but by exposing myself to this, I kind of feel like comforted that it's less likely to happen. So there's some good in it in that case. I think you just have to strike a balance between, like Andrew said, like giving respect to the victims, the reason the whole thing is taking place,
right,
balance with that natural curiosity.
Welcome back, guys. DGS on KMOX. Happy Monday to you. Our buddy Bernie Miklas joins us now, as he does Mondays and Fridays. Bern, how was your weekend?
It was good, you know, enjoyed hanging around, watching college football Friday night, and, of course, NFL playoff games over the end. Try to keep up with the Blues the best I can. But mm-hmm. It was good, man. Just leisured out and kicked back.
Good man. We were talking earlier in the show, sports, and talking about how you got to hook them when they're young and get them to be Cards fans, and they'll stay throughout their life. And I had a really interesting conversation this morning with Tommy Ackerman, and he coaches his daughter's 8th grade basketball team. And they had a rough weekend. And the girls were fine, and they were laughing and eating ice cream afterwards, and it's still bothering him today. And I told him a couple of my sports stories that I remember, and most of mine are failures. They're not successes. I remember when I dropped the ball and lost us the game. I remember when I tried to hit a home run, and the outfielder caught it and cost us the game. I remember every play, literally. I could play halfback intellectually for my high school football team. I could run a 22 power or a 26 split. Isn't it amazing how powerful sports is? Whether it's fandom or it's us being athletes, it is one of the most powerful things in life.
Well, yeah, I mean, it weighs in on so many different factors. I mean, it affects your the mood you're in. I mean, whether you're a fan or a player, like if you're a young athlete and you don't do well, you lose your confidence, you feel bad about yourself. Maybe you're aware that some people are talking about you, saying you're not any good. So, you know, a young person has to deal with that. Then as you get older, you're an athlete, you sort of recognize that there's only so many athletes that can be elite. But then it kind of dawns on you that, you know, you're not going to make it. Maybe your dreams are not going to come close to being true. And so maybe there's a letdown. Maybe you spend some time wrestling with that, just the reality of the situation. And then as fans, I think by and large, it's just like this really extreme roller coaster. I mean, you're up and you're down, you're up and you're down. You hate your team. You love your team. Oh, the team's the greatest. I wish the owner would sell this team that 3 years ago you were saying he was a great owner. You know, you just go nuts, basically. And I think that's the one thing that I've noticed through the years, both as a young athlete and then, you know, as a longtime sports writer, sportscaster, just the mood swings with sports fans, me included, man, me included. I'm not saying I'm any better than that. They tend to be extreme. A lot of times it's not as bad as we think. A lot of times it's maybe not quite as great as we think either. It's hard to stay level, though.
But I think what's amazing about it is it teaches lessons that you just aren't going to learn anywhere else until you're an adult. So if you learn them younger, I think you're at an advantage. I don't remember the exact numbers, but I saw a study of like the C-suite level executives, and like 80% of the women there played sports, and like 70% of the men there played sports. And I don't think that's a coincidence, not because sports make you special, but because you learn things there that you don't learn in a classroom, because in a classroom, you're much more on your own. It's much more about your own personal grades, you doing the work, you reading. In a team setting, yeah, it's about you, but it's got to work with the group too. And it's attention to detail. It's understanding that you're going to fail, and how do you handle that so that you don't fail the same way the next game that you play. You deal with physical pain, you deal with psychological pain, you deal with all of these things that in life you're not going to generally get exposed to until you're in the workplace or until you're an adult, and let's say maybe you're in the military or whatever. But when you learn some of those lessons as a kid, it can help you as you get to be an adult.
Yeah, because as you get to be an adult, depending on what kind of line of work you're in, but really, I think it applies to any profession. I mean, you know, if you're not a leader, that's okay. Not everyone is the leader,
right?
But you can also exert a lot of influence by understanding, you know, what it's like to be part of a team and to lead whatever you're in charge of, whatever you can control. You're doing it for the benefit of the team. You know, you put other people in mind. You're not just thinking about yourself. You know, the team comes first, which is a cliche, but it happens to be true. So I agree. I understand why really successful people have a sports background, because it teaches you a lot, good and bad.
Bern, I was telling the guys last night, I was watching Channel 5, and Frank and Mike Bush were uncharacteristically emotional with their frustration over the Cardinals and what they haven't done over the offseason yet. And then I saw that The Athletic gave them an F. Do you think that's fair? You agree?
Well, it all depends what the grading curve is. I mean, if we judge the Cardinals by their their standards under Bill DeWitt, which have been exceptional up until the last couple of years. If you look at it that way, it's kind of like how the mighty has fallen, and so you would declare it an absolute failure. But if you take time to understand what they're trying to do this winter, I don't know if I'd call them a failure. I'd call them a disappointment, and I think their off-season planning hasn't – they're sort of in the middle. They haven't really – they can't put together this youth movement because they still have Arenado. They haven't added any players. Everything's at a standstill, so it's very disappointing, although I wouldn't call it a failure because, number one, the offseason isn't over yet, and number two, once they start playing games and once we see exactly some of the evidence that it made sense to go with young players because they had to take a step back, they had to fix what was broken in the minor leagues, and that's the most important thing they can do is to get everything set up for young players in the future. So we talked about this Friday. I'm at a loss to figure out why – there are some people that, including in the media, that just can't quite grasp that the Cardinals are in a different cycle right now. And fortunately for the fans and the media and the team, the Cardinals have not really – we haven't had to deal with this kind of thing before. And so I think it freaks everybody out. They don't know what to make of it. And they assume it's just a failure rather than a necessary step that might not be the most fun thing, but it's absolutely a necessary thing. So if you put it in that context – I can tell you this, my anger level is quite controlled. I'm not angry. I get frustrated, but I'm not angry.
You know, it's fascinating. I mean, first of all, the grade at this point when the offseason's not over is a little silly. Jim Bowden wrote the article in The Athletic, and I like Jim. I've worked with Jim at MLB Network Radio. He's a good dude, but he also just likes to stir things up with these types of grades. It could be an F down the road if you finish the offseason and you haven't moved Arenado and you haven't moved the players or created the opportunity that Bernie's talking about for those younger guys. I think there's an argument that it could end up being that, but it's not that now. But I got into a back and forth with a Cardinals fan on Twitter yesterday, not an argument so much as debating about or talking about what this season is. And I can list damn near every team in baseball that has done at some point recently what the Cardinals are doing now.
No doubt about it.
The Red Sox have done it. The Cubs have done it. The Dodgers have done it. The Padres have done it. Big market teams with gigantic payrolls have done. The Astros did it, but in a way more dramatic way. They've tanked and destroyed their team. The Cardinals aren't doing that. But in sports, this is a natural part of the cycle, and you cannot like that something is necessary, but it doesn't change whether or not that thing is necessary. And this movement is necessary for the Cardinals.
Well, to add to your list, and I think we talked about this maybe on Gas House Gang, you know, it wasn't all that long ago the Atlanta Braves had like four consecutive losing seasons.
Yeah.
And it wasn't all that long ago that the Philadelphia Phillies, from after losing to the Cardinals in 2011 in that classic NLDS, Halladay versus Carpenter, the Phillies didn't make the playoffs for 10 seasons.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's the point that drives me crazy. We were talking about it today on Gas House Gang. From 1996, when Bill DeWitt became the owner, through 2022, the Cardinals had the number four winning percentage regular season in the majors, number three in the National League, and they were first in the National League and in terms of postseason wins, second overall, also first in the National League in terms of most postseason games competing in, second overall in the majors. And so, yeah, they sink. The last 2 years, their winning percentage is 22nd out of 30 teams. So that's bad. But what about all the seasons that came before it? I mean, so because they've had two lousy seasons and they haven't had postseason success, and a lot of this is their fault. I'm not exonerating them.
No,
but I'm just saying, what has happened to the loss of perspective? Where is the perspective? If you look at the entire body of work, the entire experience since 1996. It's been pretty damn impressive, actually.
Yeah.
So do you define the Cardinals by what they've been for the last couple of years, or do you define them what they were for the first 27 years? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, you do have to be a realist and understand that nothing like that lasts forever. You know, and we've talked about this a couple times. We've kind of not so much in great detail, but you know, to a degree. How long did the Whitey Ball era last? 6 years?
Not that long.
Seven years? Yep. I mean, like, and that was a great era. That era capped off a Hall of Fame managerial career for Whitey Herzog. but it didn't last for 20 years. And the truth is that it generally never does for anybody. And it again, it doesn't mean that people shouldn't end up losing jobs, changing things. It doesn't mean that it's okay, but you do need to understand that. I mean, look at the Patriots. The Patriots had their run, and Belichick and Brady left, and what happened? As soon as Brady left, it was over. I mean, but it happens to every great team. And, you know, you mentioned the Braves with four straight losing seasons, and that was recent, right? That was up until just a few years ago. I can't even find the last time the Cardinals had four straight losing seasons. I'm looking at their history right now, and I am now in the 70s, and I can't find four straight losing seasons. I don't know when the last time the last time I can find three in a row is the mid-1950s. So, like, we had a discussion today, Dave, about whether or not Cardinals fans are spoiled. I think Bernie put it into really good perspective.
Yeah,
it's not
good
so
analysis.
Much it's not so much spoiled as it is lacking in this perspective that we're talking about. Put yourselves in the shoes of fans in Pittsburgh, Cleveland, Detroit, Milwaukee, yeah. San Francisco, all these other places have gone through these things, and Cardinals fans have not.
252-DGS. I know I've told this story before, but this is the last song that, this is before Spotify or anything like that, and I saw the video for this, like the Lego thing, and I was blown away by the song. It's just so cool, and I watched that channel for hours waiting for it to come back on because I didn't catch who it was, and it was sort of magical. Now you just like tell Shazam or whatever it is, like give me that song. But back then, like you had to put some work into it, which was kind of cool.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely,
you had to kind of earn it.
Yeah, I remember the song "Feel Good Inc." by the Gorillaz.
Uh-huh.
Hearing that, I like saw it on MTV or something, and I just caught the end, and I didn't see. You know, they would always put the name of the
right.
song in the corner of the screen, and I just remembered the lyrics, and I it stuck in my head for like weeks until I could figure out who it was finally.
Did they ever show themselves?
Well, it's Damon Albarn.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's one guy, and then Damon Albarn from Blur, the singer from Blur.
Oh.
Yeah, same guy.
I didn't
guy.
Know that.
Mm-hmm. And then,
and was that a secret at the time?
No, not really, because then there's a Jamie Hewlett is the guy who does all the drawings and animation, and that's like his style and his animation. And it was just like a collaboration that ended up being really, really successful, so they kept doing it for, you know, 20 years or whatever.
Wheels, what's the first song you remember really going crazy for back when you were a kid?
Like getting hooked by it, you mean?
Yeah.
Like as a little kid, it was Van Halen. It was Eruption into She Really Got Me, or You Really Got Me. The first time I heard it, I was probably in first grade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And we were like, what is this? It's great.
Yeah, same. I was 4. And I had the mumps. I was the last kid in North America to have the mumps. And my dad, who was not this kind of dad, went to a yard sale and found Meet the Beatles and brought it home. And I just remember putting it on my little hi-fi and that, you know, that sound before it goes into the first song.
Yeah, that little blank spot at the beginning. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And just being blown away.
Yep. It's amazing how fast something can hook you, too.
Yeah.
Like, I had heard a lot of rock, right? I mean, like, my dad always had the classic rock station on in the car or whatever. So I had heard all of those things. But then the first time I heard that, I was like, uh-oh, that's different.
Am I the only one who feels, like, so silly doing the Shazam thing in public? Or like, Siri, what's the name of this song?
I've never done it.
I'm always so afraid people are going to hear me doing it. And I don't know why it embarrasses me so much, but it's just one of those like unintentionally embarrassing things.
Embarrassing because you should know who it is, or just embarrassing that you're doing it?
Just all of it.
It's a perception thing. You're being perceived as like you are enjoying the song and you want to know what it is. No, whenever I'll hit the Shazam button on my phone and like tuck it like under the, like I don't want anyone to see me. Being like, because God forbid somebody was like, oh, he likes that song.
Can't believe you didn't know that song.
Or
loser.
It's not even that. It's not even like I just don't want people to know that I like the song. I don't know. I'm a freak. I'm like terrified that somebody would judge me based on me hearing, you know, whatever like goofy pop song is on there that I'm like, this is pretty catchy. I kind of dig this.
Isn't it weird I mean, I'm obviously older than the two of you, but not that much older. But I would just never, I would, first of all, I wouldn't know how to do it. And then I would feel stupid because I would feel like I'm doing it wrong. You know, like there's an etiquette to it and I was not getting it right at all, which is probably true.